Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. Remember, this weekly podcast shows up first on a Wednesday on the Financial Mail digital platform, and then I'm told seconds later on the Apple and Spotify podcast platforms as well. I occasionally get responses, not always polite, from abroad as well, so it's burrowing a neat little niche is the Podcast from the Edge, an export, if you will. And I hope my guest today appreciates that. I'm very happy to welcome the head of policy at the Democratic Alliance, Matt Cuthbert, onto the show. It's a big moment for me because for years now I've been prattling on in my newspaper columns about what I regarded as the fact that the DA doesn't or didn't have an economic policy, and its leadership never talks about the economy in public other than to slam the latest unemployment figures or corruption or load shedding. But that may all be about to end, and it may leave me with no alternative but to stop and think of something else to write, because Matt Cuthbert has just published a document which is exactly what I've been complaining about, or the absence of which is exactly what I've been complaining about. It's an economic policy. So Matt, I know it's been quite a toil, but you've gone and done it, and for the mere fact that a DA economic policy now exists, many congratulations. Before we dive into it, can I just ask, is this now official, and have all the right people bought into it, and will they speak to it? I ask because the DA has its own bureaucracy, and that can take a while. This doesn't first need to be adopted, does it, by a Congress or the federal executive or some other gathering?
Good afternoon, Peter. It's great to be with you on the podcast. I'm an avid listener myself, and make sure that I tune in weekly on a Thursday. I find the insights that you share very, very unique and often things for us to consider as politicians, so it's great to be here with you. The policy which we launched this past Friday is fully approved, and it's a public document. You would understand that jobs is a particular issue that we'll be focusing on in the run-up to the election campaign itself. And I think since I was appointed in April last year, my focus has been to try and really orientate the party in a policy way, and in a way that's credible, where we can put together an alternative rather than merely chastising the status quo. And we've done a lot of internal stakeholder engagement. We've worked with a number of experts, reached out to a number of industry captains for input on this particular policy. And we're confident in the product that we've put out. And I think it's something that is going to gain traction, you know, amongst the chattering classes, I think amongst the ordinary public, and something which I'm really proud of my team for having produced. I think that for a long time, and you would know, it's taken about 10 years for the DA to arrive at this point where we could say we have a fully-fledged economic policy. And I look forward to no longer having to read in your columns that the DA is in fact short on this front. So I think overall it's been successful and we're in a good place.
I'm going to have to scratch my head and think of it about the DA. But just by way of introduction, Matt, because even the short summary runs to 30 or so pages, let's boil what you've done down to the six or seven headings that you give the policy and what you call bold solutions. You start with launching a startup nation, right? With small business takes flight. So that's a stake in the, you know, flag on the summit. You want small business. You want a country of startups. Your big solution here is to remove import duties on selected business tools for small business, which is quite an obscure way into it, I thought. But could you talk to that and tell us what you mean? How do you help startups by removing the import duties on the tools that they may need? What duties are we talking about, and how might it help a small business?
Sure. So as you'd know, in the automotive industry, it's a highly protected industry. There's obviously a significant amount of foreign investment in this specific industry. And, you know, we've discussed prior to this about sort of the challenges that entrepreneurs face. And I think, you know, from our perspective, we needed to recognize that it's not just big companies that are going to go out and create the kind of labor-absorptive employment that we require. It's small, medium, and micro enterprises that are really going to play a big role in alleviating what is one of the world's biggest unemployment crises. And this solution, whilst it may sound simple, is one which I think could add value, particularly to a number of mom and pop low-end fledgling businesses who are merely trying to conduct their trade. So if you think about somebody in a township or in a specifically rural area, what is the real key business tool that they require to be able to carry out their business? That is a bucky. And something as simple as removing import duties on something which, to my knowledge, is not produced locally would have a very big impact on allowing that person to actually take their business to the next level. And ultimately, what government's role should be in the economy is to create a conducive environment, one that enables people to climb up the opportunity ladder. And I think that a simple intervention like this makes a big difference in an individual entrepreneur's life, and it's something that we want to actively promote. You'll see throughout the course of the document, and specifically in the startup section, we focus on interventions that are, number one, practical. Number two, try and open up as many opportunities and avenues for small business owners to be able to thrive. Because if you look at the status quo and you look specifically at the informal economy, a lot of people are already doing wonderful and innovative things, but they're just not given the kind of support that they require. And granted, in a constrained fiscal environment, government can't disperse too much in the way of money, but there are other enabling regulations that could help make the inputs into their businesses cheaper and ultimately put them in a position for them to be able to be, fully fledged business owners who can ultimately scale their businesses and make a much larger impact on the economy.
I think you're right to actually concentrate on buckies, actually. I mean, and I'm talking particularly about rural South Africa because you have no idea what South African rural roads can do to a vehicle. They ride the roads quite frequently. I mean, they can simply destroy a vehicle. Some of the roads that we ask businesses and, at the back of beyond, and frankly, anybody using those roads, including teachers and doctors and nurses that need to get to different places. So, yeah, I like that. And as you make the point that we're about to become a country in which no small bucky is made. The Nissan's NP200 is the last one made in this country, and I think they stop in a few weeks' time. I am hoping, and I was from the VW announcement the other day, hoping that they replace the Polo and Vivo vehicles when they do with a very nice looking little bucky that they produce currently in Brazil. Anyway, the second point that you talk to is also fairly sort of homely, I suppose. You simply suggest we need to save and spend better. Sounds a little familiar when you talk there about reducing government debt and putting the money we spend on interest payments to better use. Everyone, really, almost everyone, almost every reasonable person would want to do the same. But you say, or you calculate, that there are about 450,000 jobs in getting it right. How do you get to that? How do you get to that number, I wonder?
Sure. So across the board, you would see that we've estimated that we get between about 1.9 and 2.5 million jobs. We got this econometrically modeled in consultation with a number of experts. And basically, by pulling these key levers, it would have a knock-on effect across the board, and that would then be able to generate the jobs. This is obviously not an exact science, and it is an approximation. But it is something that we are confident in, and we think that we've been rather circumspect in the numbers that we've put out. We understand that longer-term interventions on the education side, particularly basic education, higher education, will take a lot longer to bed in and a lot longer for us to be able to reform. And therefore, we need to try and pull these key levers that we have. And I think particularly in the context of savings, you've seen countries like Chile, you've seen countries like Korea that were once very impoverished, but they were able to incentivize their local populations to save and ultimately contribute towards a very high local savings rate, which could then be used to plow into investment and infrastructure construction, as well as many other positive economic multipliers. And we can say, well, we're in a very difficult economic situation locally, but are there not sort of commitment devices that we could introduce, whether that be for state workers or for private workers, to actually get people to contribute towards their future? Because I think we've got a very low savings rate as it stands in this country. I think particularly if you listen to the anecdotal stories of a number of middle-aged individuals who failed to save for their retirement and are now reliant on their parents. I think if we want to start working towards a more sustainable economy in the long run, we have to promote a savings culture in this country. And there are a variety of examples, and you would have read in the document, of this having taken place in very similar contexts such as our own. You look at Kenya and the Emakiba bonds, which they had offered. If you look at Singapore as well and the sort of financial literacy campaigns which they've run, I think these are all things that we could adapt to our own local circumstances and ultimately put ourselves in a much better, much more sustainable financial position. I think on the macro side of things, I think we need to institute fiscal discipline. I think for the most part, considering some of the sort of radical policy, I would say, that's come out of ANC manifesto launches and congresses, National Treasury have been able to temper that and ultimately run what is considered to be a relatively conservative fiscal picture. However, we do believe that steps such as having tapped Jafekra, the fact that we haven't really seen or realized any kind of serious economic multiplier despite years and years of big infrastructure spend is something that we need to really hone in on and something where we need to promote fiscal prudence, make sure that our money is being spent on those frontline services, and ultimately introduce what we call a fiscal rule. So this is a debt rule, which caps the amount of debt that government is able to leverage. Considering the fact that we spend approximately one of every five rand on servicing our debt bill, and this crowds out other expenditure on vital social services and frontline services.
So I mean, it sounds a little familiar. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Tito Mboweni, before he left the Treasury, was talking about a fiscal rule which would cap the amount of money that the state could borrow. I think we're at now over 70% of GDP, our debt. So this is not necessarily a new thought. It's a rational, careful thought, something that's current, I suspect, in the Treasury, and obviously possibly a good idea. I'm not, you know, it just seems to me to be an incredibly slow process. As you cannot, you know, you've got to set out a 5, 6, 7 year sort of glide path to get debt back under control. I also noticed, Matt, that this is where you haul in the UN's Sustainable Development Goals. This is where race raises its head, or your denial of it, or walking away from BEE. And you do say in here that you would, you would increase the child support. You convert the social relief of distress grant, that's a 350 that people get now, into a job seekers grant. You also increase child support from 530 rand to 760. And then down at the bottom of this section of the new policy, you say the DA recognizes that race-based policies have no established positive outcome for economic prosperity, and instead have led to the continual enrichment of small group of politically connected elites. The DA will remove all race-based policies by implementing a non-racial alternative to BEE, alternative to the broad-based black economic empowerment procurement system. And your alternative is to use these United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And I worry about that as an alternative. I mean, what do they offer you, the SDGs? They're just woolly, woolly nonsense. How do they help you? Maybe you can help me understand.
Sure. So I'll certainly get into that. I want to touch on two of the other issues which you raised. So we talk about converting the SRD grant into a job seekers grant. And in our policy, we suggest that we would then introduce it would in essence be a qualifier. So you would either need to be seeking work, or you would have to show evidence of having started a business. And we believe that that's a good activator to get people to be active in the market itself. It obviously can't happen in isolation. And the other reforms which we speak to are important for us to be able to implement. So you create an environment where there is more economic opportunity. And I think the staging and the timing, as well as the sequencing of this particular set of interventions, is very important. And it's, I think, in terms of getting ready to govern, that is something that we need to be very mindful of. Then we look at the child support grant. I think Daily Maverick released a story several months ago in combination with, I think, the UCT Child's Institute, where they said that we have 5 million children across the country that are going hungry. And as a party with a conscience, we believe it's exceptionally important that we raise the child support grant at least up to the food poverty line, which is approximately 760 Rand. When we had delivered our alternative budget earlier in the year, we had priced this into the existing fiscal framework and identified that it would cost us approximately 40 billion Rand to do so. And we believe that it's important to protect the vulnerable from extreme poverty. And obviously, this needs to be premised on the fact that we have growth, that we're able to generate sufficient revenue. But ultimately, with the other measures we propose in the policy, we believe that we can arrive at that point where we have more people in work, number one, and we are able to provide a more generous social package to the most vulnerable who aren't able to necessarily access economic opportunity. To the third point which you raise, which is our alternative, and see, there's been some criticism over time. This is obviously a relatively long-standing policy of the party. You would know that we previously went through a bit of an identity crisis where we weren't sure about the race question or about the BEE question. And I think that we formulated a coherent alternative which focuses and recognizes on the fact that we come from a very painful past of apartheid, colonialism, and we need to redress those effects. But we also acknowledge, on the other hand, that despite us having had race-based policy under ANC, materially the circumstances of the vast majority of South Africans who are black have not improved. And there's often a retort or quip in return to say, well, you know, there were about 7.5 to 8 million people in the black middle class that had emerged, particularly during the Mbeki presidency. And I'm willing to argue that that was as a result of the different economic policy which was pursued under that particular administration, and not necessarily as a result of race-based policy. And race-based policy has then been intensified over time. And ultimately, we still arrive at one of the highest unemployment rates in the world, north of 40% if you include discouraged work seekers. 7 out of 10 young people are unemployed. So what material impact has BEE had on those people's lives?
I guess the point I would make that occurred to me as you were talking was that, you know, this, the ANC doesn't implement anything properly. Why would it be expected suddenly because it was race-based to have done that well? Maybe there is, a properly managed race-based redress policy that would be managed. I mean, surely isn't that the DA's strength, is to do things properly? Manage it well?
Well, I think you and I have had this discussion, before, and I think it's broader than that. I think what we do in the Western Cape is really good within a limited policy space that you have as a provincial government. We're obviously busy fighting to take over more powers. But ultimately, as a Liberal Party and as a party of the center, we need to position ourselves as a different stall. And I think our fundamental commitment to non-racialism is evident in this particular policy. And it focuses on some really good stuff. If you look at what the SDGs are, things like no poverty, decent work, clean energy, amongst many others, and you then say, well, we need to get companies to invest in these things in order for them to be able to do business with the state, and we replace the existing race-based point system with one that focuses on businesses' contribution to that, and considering that, you know, companies across the world have implemented the SDG in some or other form, and you can then align your government departments to deliver on those SDGs, I think that it becomes an idea with much merit, and one which allows us to move away from the race-based policies which have plunged this country to a large extent into an unemployment crisis, an inequality crisis, and ultimately a poverty crisis.
Well, the implementation of race-based policies by the ANC may have plunged us into the crisis, but what my question is, I mean, are the, you know, the SDGs are really soft little cookies. I mean, Surely they're not a viable alternative to calling redress by its name. I mean, who even remembers the 17 SDGs, right? So how would you reward a company for, say, complying with goal 8, which is decent work and economic growth? Now, how does my company, I make, you know, paper bags for cement producers. How do I get rewarded? How do I even influence decent work and economic growth? Or goal 16, peace, justice, and strong institutions. I mean, you know, it's miles away from what I do for a living.
Sure, and I take your point, but I think particularly in terms of economic growth, and something that's quite a direct impact is if you are creating employment in your local area, you by extension would have an impact on economic growth. If we look at the kind of targets that are set in the existing annual performance plans as well as the budgets, one could argue that they are relatively abstract, but yet you're still able to translate those into tangible outcomes and goals for departments to develop their policy and their programs and allocate budget around. And I think it would be right-sizing those particular initiatives in those departments to make sure that there's a tangible impact that is actually derived from it. And in the local municipality of Umgeni, where my colleague, Mayor Chris Pappas, has been the mayor for closely 2.5 years, they've started implementing the SDG framework in all of their APPs and their municipal planning so that when there's an initiative or policy program that's implemented, they actually measure it against it. And it seems to be having good purchase in that particular municipality. So who's to say we couldn't scale that on a national level and implement it if we are to get into government after the 29th? Furthermore, we've also fleshed this out in a private members bill, which we had put in roughly about 6 months ago, where we talk about how this could specifically relate to procurement policy. And I invite you and your listeners to go and have a read of that particular social impact bill, and to see how we could tangibly turn our economic justice policy into something that is an effective way of targeting those key drivers of poverty and inequality in this country.
Just one last thing. On this converting the Social Relief of Distress grant, the SRD grant, the 350 to a job seekers grant, Matt, a lot of the people getting this grant are going to be old and not well and incapable and live miles away from where anything remotely that looks like a job even exists. How would you possibly expect them to cope without that money if they couldn't get it, if they can't?
So I think we must be mindful of how the grants are separated and distributed. So you would have a child social grant that would be allocated to a parent, particularly a young mother who'd be looking after children. There's also a situation where people leave their children with relatives, and then that money is filtered back to the relatives to be able to provide for that child or those children. You then have an old age pension, which is also provided by SASA, and that specifically focuses on old people. You have a disability grant, which focuses on those who are disabled. But the SRD grant specifically would focus on individuals who are of a working age but unable to be absorbed into the labor force. And this is not something that can ultimately act in isolation. You need the kind of economic reforms in place to make sure that there's an enabling environment. And as we've discussed in the other measures we put forward in our policy, a combination of these interventions will allow us to be able to activate people to be able to seek work. I want to use a similar example of what we've done in the Western Cape. And whilst a provincial government has, you know, very limited scope to be able to provide a grant of its own, they have gone above and beyond to provide what they call a work seekers voucher, where they use a particular amount of money a month. I think it's roughly about 200 Rand, but I do stand to be corrected. And they use that money to enable young people to go for their first job, hand out their CV, and there's a sort of a after-market service that the provincial government provides to help secure young people work. And this is sort of what we envision for converting the SRD grant into a job seekers grant. And it's something which has worked very well in other countries such as Brazil, which find themselves in very similar economic context.
Yeah.
And something which I think could have merit in the South African context.
Okay. Let's go on to the next point. You once again, it's quite a generic point that you make, but it's a good one. Stop interference with the Reserve Bank. And I suppose the question one needed to ask, well, you know, a lot of politicians stand up and they, you know, Julius Malema wants to nationalize the Reserve Bank, and, you know, a lot of people don't think that it's doing its job properly because it's being too strict on interest rates and inflation. But the Reserve Bank under the ANC thus far has been largely and pretty admirably independent. Our Reserve Bank governor was named Reserve Bank governor, Central Bank governor of the year a couple of years ago. What's the problem? Why is it why do you need to put that pole in the ground?
Well, I think whilst government scope to intervene in the Reserve Bank is limited, I think it's important to protect the independence of the Reserve Bank, particularly in light of the 2017 resolution which came before the ANC policy conference. One would have thought that would have died down once the RET faction had left the ANC to a large extent, but it doesn't seem to have gone away. And there are all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas that we need to expand the mandate of the Reserve Bank. And I agree with your sentiments that they've really done an excellent job in an otherwise underwhelming sea of incompetence from a government perspective. I think they are an internationally credible institution. They have done everything that they possibly can within their power to protect the value of our currency, to try and minimize volatility to the best of their power. And ultimately, what we really need in this country is fiscal policy to complement monetary policy rather than trying to add an additional load to the monetary policy administrators. And that's the point that we are trying to get across here, that the South African Reserve Bank can only do so much to contain inflation, can only do so much to provide macroeconomic stability. But if Treasury don't meet them halfway, then we are never going to be able to get out of the quagmire that we currently find ourselves in. And I think it's, whilst maybe a boring point, an important point to underscore, considering the fact that we find ourselves in a desperate set of economic circumstances. And this, you know, allows for rather radical ideas to be bred. And I think we need to sort of put an end to that and come out very strongly in defense of the work that's been done, because we wouldn't have had international acclaim for this institution if it wasn't doing its job. And I think that despite the difficult circumstances, they have done their best.
Yeah. And your bold solution in this particular chapter is to reduce the number of sectors where prices are administered. Is that because the administered prices are inflationary, or is there something I'm missing?
100%, because they're inflationary. You look at electricity, rail, transport, and the like, they all add additional costs onto inputs, into critical goods that businesses and people need to use in order to produce goods, sell those goods in a market, and be able to generate some sort of economic value. And ultimately, if you make those inputs cheaper and more affordable for business owners to be able to use and process, then you're going to have a knock-on effect for economic growth. And as we know, with labor absorbed with economic growth, it creates jobs. And we understand what a big constraining factor our electricity supply is, the fact that we pay as much as what we do, and yet we don't have a regular and consistent supply of it, alongside a number of other network industries which have administered prices in place. And that's why I think it's critical for us to be able to control those factors within National Treasury and the other relevant departments' ambit, instead of applying that pressure on the Reserve Bank, who themselves, despite these circumstances, are trying to tame inflation to the best of their ability.
Just one thing that stands out, you know, you want to interfere less with the Reserve Bank, but one of the points you make in this section is to avoid repeated foreign exchange interventions. I'm not sure whether this is a windmill you're tilting at. I don't know that the Reserve Bank intervenes in the Forex market to protect the rand, as you say. But isn't that a sort of instruction you're giving it to? I mean, isn't it up to them whether they intervene in the market or not, or does it have to come from the government?
Well, I don't think that this is necessarily an intervention on our part. I think it's more of a sort of sentiment point here to say, well, we shouldn't go back to where we were in 1998. The previous Reserve Bank governor had aggressively tried to purchase foreign exchange under some sort of impression that he'd be able to bolster the currency, and it didn't have the desired effect. And it's sort of just a warning to say, let's not go down that road again.
Then you get to getting South Africans working. Labor policies must focus on growing jobs to provide unemployed South Africans with a pathway out of poverty. And the big point that you make here is the introduction of what you're calling a DA, or a youth employment opportunity certificate. What is this thing?
So basically, what the certificate is, it allows a young person who's been long-term unemployed of 12 months or more to basically apply for the certificate to the Department of Labor and be able to approach a company and say, you know, I'm willing to forego the minimum wage so I can get my foot in the door, earn experience, and ultimately be able to climb up the social mobility ladder. The fact is the longer that you remain unemployed, the less likely you are to ever be employed. And when we have a 40% plus unemployment rate, including discouraged work seekers, we really need to create more options for a flexible labor environment. You would have seen that this obviously raised Kosatu's ire this past weekend in the Sunday Times.
Oh, yeah, you hate the workers.
And we were accused of that we hate workers and all sorts of other strange charges. But if we really look at the labor regime which Kosatu, the SACP and the ANC and the Alliance have crafted, it's one which actually keeps the vast majority of South Africans trapped in unemployment and ultimately puts people in a very, very difficult position unless they are a unionized employee. And we question that logic.
Yeah, but why is it so hard to make this point? Why has that survived as long as it has, as intact as it has? It's quite remarkable the way the unions are.
Well, I think when you've got a president and you've got at least five former cabinet ministers who were all active trade unionists, and I know your and my shared favorite one, Ibrahim Patel, is quite fervent on this point, then you're going to get government policy that's skewed towards the labor unions and particularly Kosatu. And I think there's few political actors and other political parties that are willing to challenge them on this front. And I think that it's a worthy fight to take up. Ultimately, we want more people in jobs. We want less people reliant on the state. And the only way we do that is by creating an enabling environment for people to access that economic opportunity. Do you want people, I certainly don't, to be confined to a life of sitting at home or never having had the opportunity to actually, you know, earn a decent wage or be able to get promoted or be able to have some sort of dignified livelihood? And basically what Kosatu says is, well, you know, the wages that people of their own agency are willing to accept is distasteful, and therefore we should not allow them to do so. I can tell you that the vast sentiment amongst the unemployed masses is that people just want to get their foot in the door. And I think that Kosatu are a key stumbling block in them actually being able to realize that.
Yeah. So you in this section you talk about not dropping the minimum wage, but sort of freezing it wherever it is when you take over the government. You leave the existing minimum wage in place without increasing it further, allowing inflation to gradually erode its value, which of course has produced all sorts of news stories over the weekend, as if it were even interesting. I mean, so, you know, you have to be careful here because you don't want to create a country in which people will literally work for almost nothing. And, you know, I was just in the little village where I live, I was quite astonished the other day, yesterday, in fact, it was on Sunday, driving through the village, and I must have seen at least three or four houses whose gardeners were working on a Sunday. And I just thought that was outrageous, you know, and it really irritated me. How do you open up this labor market, but how do you also keep it fair and humane?
Sure. So I think that speaks to a different issue, particularly working on Sundays. There's obviously legislative requirements that people should be paid times two on a Sunday. And I think that there are people who casually think that they can ignore the labor laws. And in our proposal, and that specifically focuses on the minimum wage, we still are fundamentally committed to all of the other working protections in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. But I do agree with you that it's important to make sure that people are not exploited, that we are not abusing people. But if people decide, well, the real minimum wage when you are unemployed is R0, and you want to use your own individual agency to earn less than the average, we should allow people to make that decision for themselves rather than government dictating to them.
But you have to promise, surely, you have to promise that there'd be very, very tight policing of abuses of those people, because they would be going into jobs as an act of utter desperation in some cases.
100%. And I think we are in a very desperate set of circumstances at this moment in time, Peter. And ultimately, the decision is as follows. There's a couple of decisions, actually. You can sit at home and be confined to a R0 wage. You can alternatively apply for an SRD grant of R350. But if you just took half of the minimum wage, for example, your purchasing power would be more than five times what an SRD grant is. And you're not going to earn that in perpetuity. You're going to build experience. There's a chance of being promoted. And ultimately, you will have your foot in the door. So it's not a nice situation to be in as a country where you have unemployment north of 40%. But we are in really desperate circumstances, and we need to try and pull each and every policy lever we can to get people into work so that they are able to contribute towards expenditure in the economy and ultimately add economic value in the long term.
Yeah. The other point you make is you're going to amend the NEDLAC Act to explicitly include job creation and poverty reduction as one of its objectives. So this is a way of ensuring that economic policy is properly costed, I presume.
Yes, that is correct. And making sure that
at the moment, there is nobody bothers in this country, or the ANC doesn't bother to cost its own proposals. I was just reading this morning, Gwede Mantashe has just tabled a gas master plan draft, which envisages all sorts of money being spent on useless assets, in my view, but with not a single penny attached to, not even an estimate of costs attached to it. That's outrageous.
100% agree with you. And I think it's a common problem across, a number of political parties in the country. And I think also on an international scale, where politicians go out and they promise things to voters, or they come up with policy ideas, but they fail to think of the real life implications of the policy actions that they take. And maybe if I can just take us back one notch, if we look at specifically what wage costs are in South Africa, and we look at this in the context of master plans, the kind of protections that are provided by the DTIC, this is all to compensate for what is, compared to other developing countries, a relatively expensive labor rate, and for all of the other failures that we have across the board, electricity, water, and the like, and the fact that a number of companies are having to actually invest in these things rather than them having been supplied by government as you would ordinarily in any other country that's trying to grow and actually generate job creation. And that's what these policies actually try and compensate for. And I think that's really the key point to be made here.
Yeah. And the unions will love you for some of the stuff in this particular section, where you're going to broaden the collective bargaining system so it's more representative of bargaining parties, exempting small, medium, and micro enterprises from the expense of bargaining and from the decisions some of these bargaining councils make. But you're also going to require unions to make a deposit to an appropriate independent body before embarking on a legal strike. You're going to require unions to publish their audited financial statements every year. You're going to require union officials to disclose their earnings in annual reports. And you're going to prevent non-tax compliant unions from calling a strike. They're going to absolutely love you.
Oh, 100%. I'm surprised that when old Matthew Parks climbed into me yesterday in a rather strangely written statement, that these were not many of the issues that were mentioned. Yeah. But ultimately, I think that particularly ANC-aligned unions have got away with impunity over the years. They've brought cities to a standstill. They've inflicted major infrastructure damage. And what consequences have there been? And I think South Africans are respectful of the fact that unions have played a critical role in protecting workers' rights over the last 40, 50 years. But if they're going to inflict damage on people's livelihoods, then they need to be held accountable. Do they have a right to assemble and freedom of association and right to protest? Yes. But considering what we know and what evidence shows us, that they are inclined towards damaging public infrastructure, there being massive economic consequences as a result of their actions, we believe that we need to hold them accountable. You also hear about, you know, CEOs pay packets on a continuous basis. And rightfully so, we must hold people accountable, and that's the role of unions to do so. But why do they then not disclose what their big union bosses earn, which is, I can tell you now, in excess of R1 million? And why are they not putting forward that information if they are so interested in transparency? Surely this is a two-way street. And if you expect transparency from someone else, then you yourself must be transparent.
Yeah. The next point you make, you talk about creating growth and not oligopolies. This involves getting the basics right. But there are some interesting points that you make about industrial policy generally. And I'd like to come back to industrial policy after we discuss this part. But you want to scrap the master plans, these are Ibrahim Patel's master plans for things like textiles and steel, cars, and poultry, etc., etc. You're going to cancel master plans, and you're going to cancel these awful reciprocal agreements that he forces importers to make if they import a product that may one day be made in South Africa. And the reciprocal agreement was you can import the product now, but if some South African company, i.e. particularly, I suspect in Patel's case, because he's got this black industrialist program going, if a black industrialist makes something in South Africa, you can't import the same product. But you'll scrap that.
100% we'd scrap it. If you look at Patel's worldview, one which is very statist, one which has actively contributed towards a loss in jobs in sectors such as textiles, then evidence shows us that master plans have not been successful. And ultimately, what has been created here is once again another insider-outsider stitch-up where certain companies with privileged access to the minister as well as his associates are able to get a better deal than other companies operating in similar industries. And if we had focused on fixing all of the network infrastructure, the electricity, the rail, the ports, as well as water, and made sure that we had a competitive labor rate, then we wouldn't need to compensate with all of these ridiculous import protection policies and forms of localization. And I think it's just ludicrous to actually try and protect something that is not produced locally. If there is no competitive advantage or specialization locally, then all you're going to end up doing is actually hurting the consumer in their pocket when they're having to purchase this good. And you're limiting their opportunity and their ability to be able to get something that is probably of a better quality and probably far more cost effective. And I know that you've written extensively about this. I myself have written extensively about this. But it's sort of as if there's some kind of cognitive dissonance that we keep on doing the same thing over and over and we expect a different result. And reciprocal agreements, I think in particular, are extractive. They dictate terms which I don't think that businesses need to agree to, and they constrain enterprise. Surely we want to be getting our businesses to scale up, to be able to invest more in our country and ultimately create more jobs. And the way in which the current policy agenda has been fashioned doesn't allow for those things to happen.
Yeah. You also, the point that I was interested in over the weekend, a column I wrote for the Sunday Times about electric vehicles. So VW, about 2 weeks ago, announces a 4 billion rand investment in Karife, near PE, and they're going to make an SUV there. And they will phase out in a few years. They'll phase out the Polo and Vivo that they make. But it was clear from the announcement to me, but nobody seemed to pick it up. And I haven't heard the complaint yet, but there's no doubt one coming. But that they've chosen not to make electric vehicles in South Africa, despite the fact that Ibrahim Patel has come up recently, in December, with an EV master plan of his own. And you're basically saying, you reconsider the import duties on electric vehicles. I'm sure you mean by cutting it. And what's so interesting is you change the focus of the industrial policy where you say, listen, at the moment what we do is we subsidize manufacturing of cars in South Africa, but perhaps we should find some way of incentivizing or helping the sale of vehicles in South Africa. And I like that. How would you go about all of that?
So I think starting off with the electric vehicles, there's widespread evidence out there that we are moving towards an international market that is, you know, rapidly adopting electric vehicles as opposed to combustion engines. So you would have seen in the UK in particular that they planned on phasing them out by 2030. Whether or not that's realistic, I think that's a matter for debate. But ultimately, if we want to be able to survive in the sort of new market conditions, then we need to be able to adapt our policy, number one. Number two, we've got certain climate commitments, which we are a signatory to as a country, and we want to try and diversify our energy mix, number one, and we want to try and introduce cleaner technologies. We've sort of seen the steps that have been taken on the renewable energy front, and, you know, Eskom themselves have attributed the fact that there's been a record uptake in solar installations on the fact that we don't have as much load shedding as what we would have had in the past. And we've really got to think outside of the box when it comes to trying getting these technologies in the country, getting them in cheaper so that people actually have access to them. There are a couple of electric vehicles on the market locally, and I can tell you that they are prohibitively expensive, and that is because of all of the duties that are associated with them. And I think it's something that we really need to consider. From a subsidies perspective, you will see there's a rather interesting table in the policy which we discuss. And basically, what we are saying here is if you look at automotive subsidies in particular as a separate line item, and this is a hypothetical line item on a budget or a national budget, it is almost 31 billion rand in cost. And it's something like the ninth largest if you were to include it in as a line item on the national budget. Now, that's a significant amount of money to be subsidizing a particular industry. And that's not to say that the automotive industry don't play a critical role, particularly in provinces like your home province of the Eastern Cape. But we need to reevaluate whether or not this suits our local context, whether or not these skills are transferable from working in the automotive space to other, you know, sort of manufacturing spaces where those kinds of cognate skills can be used. And then also identifying an opportunity for retail sales where a larger proportion of the jobs in the automotive industry are located. Why don't we use that as a jobs and economic multiplier instead? And I think it's something that we really have to consider moving forward if this is going to be a growth sector for us moving into the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Matt, your next, I'm going to hurry along a little bit. So your next chapter involves enhancing competitiveness, and this is trade policy, where you want to look once again at the way we currently use quite stiff import duties to protect local industries or even monopolies a little bit, or quasi-monopolies like ArcelorMittal and steel. And you will you'll run a sort of a tractor or a grader through those. You're going to remove all export duties. So currently, if you do want to export things, and some of them you just can't. You can't export scrap from this country any longer, I don't think. excuse me. But that would help with exports. Basically, what you're trying to say here is you want to turn our industry around from rather being this kind of inwardly focused, localize everything, protect, and you want to say, let's go and export our way into wealth, right?
100%. I think that the localization path which government and particularly Patel have forged has not been one which has generated the kind of economic benefits that they were looking for. And I think that we need a totally different approach towards trade and industrial policy. We need to focus on getting those basics right, so infrastructure, safety, security, making sure we have the necessary skills and human capital so that we can take advantage of the kind of local conditions that we have before deciding that we are going to pick winners and losers in the economy. Let's look at scrap in particular. Despite the scrap ban that's been put in place, we look at the PPS system and the like, that hasn't stopped criminals from going to go and steal cable from our streetlights, from our energy sources, transformers and the like, whatsoever. I think cable theft has actually accelerated over time. So what is the point then of slapping an export duty on it? Also, why do you want to pay somebody to export something to another country? Surely we should be trying to enter as many additional international markets as we possibly can. And it seems rather counterintuitive to me that you would want to slap an export duty on something that you could actually generate revenue from and add economic value. It's absolutely nonsensical in my mind.
Yeah. You say the DA is going to optimize special economic zones, SEZs, to generate economic growth and create jobs. And I was wondering, your former leader, Musi Mamani, said something I liked about a year or so ago. He said, why don't we turn the entire country into an SEZ? Why is it, you know, why do we have to sort of make things, you know, dot the country with these special zones? Everybody needs this kind of innovation, surely.
I think in principle, that's not a bad idea at all. But I think we've really missed the boat on what SEZs were really intended for. So if you look at the Chinese model, which is sort of the originator of this idea, it was used as a sort of policy laboratory to test various ideas. So things like wages, looking at import duties, looking at work permitting and the like, and, you know, certain other exemptions which incentivize businesses to want to invest there. And I think it's sort of veered away from that focus to being a sort of glorified business park where you have businesses that are located in these SEZs, and yes, they'll get incentives, but they're not necessarily fit for purpose and actually aligned with what the intention of that SEZ was. And I think this is about saying, well, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's take these SEZs, and you'll see we've proposed a steel SEZ in particular, to test this out, see whether or not there's purchase in these policy ideas. And if this is something that works in that SEZ, let's then take that and mirror that across the country and on a more macro level, try and apply these policy changes. And we may just see some sort of different result by taking that action rather than just allowing them to sort of wither away. I mean, when I served on the portfolio committee on trade, industry and competition, we went to a number of SEZs that were nothing more than glorified business parks. I went to that Messina Mercado one where they'd built a road and basically had three Wendy houses. And that was the extent of what the SEZ was several years later. And surely we need to, considering the fact that a significant amount of money has been pumped into these SEZs, be getting real purchase out of them and actually using them to sort of foster good ideas which can then be applied in other areas.
Yeah. So you end off saying that you want to be pro-market, not pro-business, and you propose some pretty stiff amendments or changes in competition policy, which, of course, the ANC and Ibrahim Patel in particular uses sort of weaponized in order to become it's become a tool of industrial policy. But your bold solution is to repeal the public interest provisions from the Competition Act, which would be quite something.
Most certainly. And I think what we've seen, particularly under Patel, and I think this has been aided and abetted by President Ramaphosa, is that he sort of has a free hand to interfere in markets as he likes. And not only does he set industrial policy, trade policy, and the like, but he's now started interfering in the role of the Competition Commission. And this particular clause in the Competition Commission Amendment Act allows him to do so. And we saw a stark example of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think roughly 3 years ago with the Grand Parades investment, where the black-owned Grand Parades were prevented from actually selling their business to an American investor because it would somehow interfere with the transformation talks. So basically what he is then saying is that if this business is no longer economically viable for you and you happen to be a black business owner, you now need to be stuck with a white elephant because this will change the way in which we racially be incomed. Yeah. And I think that's very counterintuitive. We need to make sure that we've got fair market conditions for all.
Yeah. So you remove the tribunal, the competition tribunal, remove the minister and you remove the president from any decision-making at all in the merger approval process.
Well, you would still have the tribunal, but it would be the minister in particular that would be removed from this process. And also his role in the Competition Commission Amendment Act would be circumscribed. You would also see that there are a number of other provisions which government is wanting to include surrounding national security. And this would then be implemented by the president, to my understanding. And before that even comes into force, that is something that we would like to scrap. And the reason for that is surely, yes, national interest security concerns are important, but should this factor into our competition policy? I really struggle to believe that. And I think that this is just an, you know, ever-increasing encroachment by the state on the market rather than allowing the market to be a free and fair market for all.
Yeah. And just lastly then, you dismantle state monopolies on electricity, rail, water, and ports. You're not dismantling the companies, you're just dismantling the monopolies. In other words, you'll allow competition into those areas. Is that right?
Yeah, most certainly. So I think, particularly with the unbundling, we're obviously waiting for this to be finalized, but there is certainly a role for the likes of an Eskom to play in terms of being a market operator, grid operator. But they should not be the only game in town when it comes to power generation. And I think we've seen that with the 50 megawatt cap being scrapped and the kind of renewable energy that has come online. And ultimately, there's a role for them to play, and there should be a balanced and phased approach towards privatization. But they can't also continue to be a drain on the fiscus because they are inefficient and they are not able to deliver what they were intended to do.
Yeah. So, Matt, does all this have to wait until you get into government? And I have to say, I mean, I think the odds on that happening this time around will surely have to be quite long. Or can we expect to see shades of these ideas in areas where the DA does govern?
So I think there is certainly some work to be done on taking particularly some of our small business proposals into our provincial and our local governments. Obviously, trade policy and industrial policy in some respects are largely the reserve of national government. But as we've seen in the Western Cape, for example, there is a way of pursuing infrastructure-led growth by focusing on making sure that, number one, there is safety and security, making sure that you have roads that work, making sure that you've got public facilities under your control that work, and making sure that you invest, like our mayor in the city of Cape Town, Jordan Hill-Lewis, has done, in infrastructure in your city, where he spent almost 70% of that budget on infrastructure. And I think those are the kind of mechanisms that we can use to try and realize this economic policy in a tangible way, rather than it being a 60-page tome, as one analyst referred to it, and actually bringing it to life and using it as a means to actually bring about the kind of change people are so desperately seeking. Yeah.
And when you talk about the SEZ and the policy, tell me what's in your mind. I mean, you know, what sort of investment are you attracting? Are we surely not by now manufactured out? You know, if you're betting on a manufacturing future for the South African economy, I would have thought you were 40 years too late. I mean, it's done. What could we possibly make that anyone else would want to buy that isn't already being made? Yeah, like cars. And you know, to try now to get the world's best, I don't know, Bucky canopy maker to come to South Africa. There's a big one in Thailand, I see. Try and get them to come here now. They're done. I mean, they don't need, you know, that proposition that you make to bring manufacturing to your country is surely dying now. I mean, whatever is being made where it is. I mean, what else will humanity need that we could reasonably make here in a factory?
Sure. So I think from our perspective, we are sector agnostic, and that's why we speak specifically to what we have adopted, which is an industrial policy pyramid, which focuses on what we believe the key factors are for industrialization and ultimately for growth. But specifically, and you would look at the proposal we put forward on the SEZ, I think there's a lot of competition, particularly in the downstream steel sector and particularly steel fabrication. And I think by virtue of the structure of the master plans, the sort of policy approach that's currently in place, we favor the upstream at the expense of the downstream. And I think there's a lot of labor absorptive potential in downstream steel for us to really have a competitive advantage. We've got some people in this country who can really do amazing stuff with steel and be able to process it and fabricate it in such a way that they add significant value. And that obviously has quite a high level of desirability in international markets. And I think that that's something, for an example, with still maintaining our sector agnosticism, that I think could really be pursued. And ultimately, we need to look at what the trends are. I think BDO in particular, so business processing, call centers, considering the strength that we have in being English speakers, I think that's something that's really, picked up quite nicely. I think to a large extent, India pipped us for a while because they obviously have a population who speak very good English and are able to really control that market space. But I think there's still some growth room there. And I think we need to be alert and vigilant to any kind of opportunity that's going to create labor absorptive growth and ultimately contribute towards the livelihoods of South Africa.
Are we not kidding ourselves about labor-absorbed growth? We've got a growing population. We're never going to employ all these people. And AI is going to make it even more difficult. Because everybody then through AI will be able to get a skill almost instantly. How do you make X? Yeah, click here and it'll show you. There'll be a video. And it'll understand what you're doing. It'll tell you, do it with the left hand or the right hand. I mean, it's not, I just wonder whether we are even remotely beginning to prepare, whether it's the DA or the ANC or whoever, for the future of work. It's horrific what's going to happen. It feels horrific anyway. If AI is as, particularly if the damage from AI isn't AI itself, but people who know how to use it and how to bend it to their interests.
I think there's definitely a number of developments to monitor regarding AI and the fact that there's less reliance on labor. However, I think in the South African context, there are still levers that we are able to pull, and I think many of them are found in our economic policy, which can still result in labor absorptive growth. And I think there's a lot of unrealized potential that we can take advantage of to achieve that. And there are a number of sectors, which I believe are labor intensive, which with the right kind of conditions, the right kind of enabling policies and regulatory environments would be able to thrive in particular. And I think that it's up to government to make sure that they put in place those basics so that those opportunities can be utilized with a view on monitoring what the international developments are and how we best respond to that. But ultimately, it comes down to the following. You can do so much in a particular policy document, whether that be a manifesto, whether that be an economic policy. And I think there will always be challenges that arise. But I think it's about operating with dexterity, making sure that as new evidence becomes available, that you respond appropriately and craft a response to it. And keep alive to the fact that things are not going to stay the same. And you need to make sure that you've got an agile state which is able to actually put in place the necessary measures to mitigate any kind of risks that may come from the adoption of new technologies and the kind of implications that it have for our local labor workforce.
Yeah. So very lastly, I was a little surprised that you didn't push harder in this document on entrepreneurship. I know that you make a point about making it easier to start a business and to make it cheaper to import the tools that small business needs. But I just don't think that you've sufficiently explored the other possibility. And I know you were worried about, spending money that the fiscus didn't have. But there's got to be a way, surely, of incentivizing enterprise as well as just making it easier to do. Whether you are giving somebody a tax incentive just for starting a company, a tax incentive for employing somebody. It doesn't have to be big, but it has to be an advantage. A tax incentive can you not use more policy instruments to make starting businesses more attractive to more people? Because it's not in the document. It's not in the policy.
So it's in the longer format of the policy, and maybe this is the problem when you have two versions. But we do speak to the idea of incentivizing commercial banks and credit unions to expand their reach into underserved communities. You would have seen the excellent work that Grameen Bank has done in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
And we believe by creating the right kind of... Yeah, we believe by creating the right kind of incentives, and this is obviously a discussion that needs to take place between government and the banks, that we would be able to increase access to microfinance, aftermarket support that small businesses require. And in addition to that, another alternative proposal which we've put on the table, which is something which has actually taken place in Sweden, is to have sort of an alternative funding mechanism that's administered by the JSC, where you can have IPOs or initial public offerings, and the business can come there with their business plan. They can present it to a group of angel investors, venture capitalists, and say, this is my idea, this is what I plan on doing. They can provide a level of support to those specific individuals, and then obviously bid like some sort of a virtual shark tank on those ideas to make sure that they're funded and that people are actually able to realize what their entrepreneurial aspirations are.
If I'm living in Kumbu or part of rural South Africa, I don't have that possibility. I want to start a spaza shop, or I want to start a bottle store. And I'm going to employ 5 people. What bank is going to talk to me? I mean, why can I not just get taxed less for trying?
Sure, and I think you make a valid point. And as I say, you know, no economic policy can be entirely exhaustive, and I'm not going to sit here this afternoon and say that we've thought of everything. I mean, I think it's impossible. There's only so much one can include. But what I will say is, particularly for smaller and micro enterprises, there are some other things which we've proposed which I think could actually benefit, individuals in that particular position. So you look at informal traders, for example, and simplifying the applications for them and making sure that you don't do what some city mayors have done previously by chasing people off the streets. Rather, help people comply and make it easier for them to sell their goods. So that's one. Secondly, looking at different trading spaces in areas that are probably more middle class, more affluent, where people can use these spaces to actually have access to a market. Looking at things as simple as, you know, internet access, and considering the rate of mobile phone penetration we have in this country, it can make a massive impact on a small or micro enterprise. And then ultimately sort of inculcating that culture of entrepreneurial spirit within schools, getting the Department of Basic Education, people who are willing to give of their time to collaborate with young people who are interested in starting their own businesses and don't want to just be employees, and trying to develop that from very early on. And I think that those are really some of the measures that we've put forward, which I think would not necessarily be all that expensive, and number two, find quite a bit of relevance, particularly amongst that constituency.
Yeah. Matt, we're going to have to stop there. Thank you so much for joining me, and I hope your leader gets an opportunity to speak to some of what you've done in the past few weeks, in the time still left before the election. I promise I'll never say the DA doesn't have an economic policy again, or not for a fair good while. I do recommend that people interested in economic policy generally have a look. This is probably on the DA website. But thank you again, and thank you all for listening. It's much appreciated. I'll see you back here again next week. Stay safe.